This episode of The Python Perspective is brought to you by Ovine Air. Ovine Air, sponsored by Clever Sheep, piloted by Brian Trubshaw.
Ici, où se trouve le petit capitaine anglais, Monsieur Trubshaw?
Vive Brian, whatever you are.
Once he's done piloting the sonic barrier-breaking Concorde jet for the first time, he's going to be flying sheep around in first, second, and third class.
Un, deux, trois, merde, merde.
Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Suivez la piste.
We're going to talk about Suivez la piste later. I've got an interesting little bit on that. But before we get to there, how are you, Nate?
I'm very good. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well. I'm excited to be here. Excited that here today on the 12th of October, we are here talking about Monty Python's Flying Circus. Episode 2, Sex and Violence.
This is a really great episode. This brings about the first presentation of how Brits feel about French people.
Now, the episode starts off pretty quick with a big part 2, sheep, which leads into the French bit. I'm convinced in the abstract that this was a gag that the BBC didn't want to mess with. It's well known that this was the broadcast that was recorded first. On August 30th, 1969, this was the one that they recorded first in the studio in front of a live audience, but it was broadcast second. And I think that to have it be part two right from the start is a good joke. It's the good kind of boundary-breaking joke that the Pythons love. And I think the BBC said, oh, well, this is episode two, and shifted it to part two because they didn't get the joke, or they didn't want the confusion, or they didn't want the calls coming in of people being, wait, what happened to episode one? Did we miss it? They didn't want the trouble. On the other hand, the first sketch with the farmer and the city man leaning against a fence.
Oh, good afternoon.
Arnish.
Lovely day, isn't it?
Tis that.
Is one of the most awkward, most high school drama production, most clumsy looking bits of set construction and production I've seen on the show. It is so early and so young and so bad that I can also see maybe the BBC being like, you know what, let's quietly shift this to week two so that the reviews aren't entirely. I watched the first 15 seconds and I thought, where are my license fees going? This is repellent, repulsive. We could be doing better. Even at 10:55 on a Sunday night, replacing a religious broadcast, we should be doing better than this.
You can see the shadows of the two actors on the matte painting behind them.
I say, there's all sheep, aren't they? Yes, of course, I thought so. why are they up in the trees?
Yeah. This is very, very, yeah, as you say, a high school mistake. Also, the sort of pantomiming that they do of trying to follow a sheep as it walks back and forth.
Observe their behavior. Take for a start the sheep's tendency to wop about the field on their back legs.
You can kind of tell they had to work on that, and they had to count 1, 2, 3, which on your head, 1, 2, 3. It's not perfect, but
I do enjoy the off-screen voices of whomever they have doing the sheep. It is unclear to me who's doing the meh, meh, meh bits of the various attempting flying sheep. The pantomime's not great, but the voices of whomever they have doing the falling, plummeting sheep is pretty great.
Notice they do not so much fly as plummet.
And the other piece that's astonishingly amateurish is Graham Chapman's makeup. Graham Chapman is playing a rustic farmer leaning against a post, and he has blush on like you wouldn't believe. By the time this episode is being broadcast, the HD Blu-rays restorations of the box set of Monty Python's Flying Circus will have been commercially released by Network, and you'll be able to see in even more astonishing clarity just how incongruously pink his cheeks are and how painted on they are. I look at that scene and I think, they did not have it together yet. And so when Palin writes in his diaries that he was scared to pieces about doing it and that they'd done it in front of the tech audience a couple days before and thought it to be just appallingly bad, and they were worried that they were ever should do this in the first place, I'm not surprised that that is their lead in.
If you look at this, just as say it was an improvised scene, which of course it's not, but say if you look at that, it starts off in a very kind of trips on itself kind of way, because they really force the interaction in a very awkward way. As you know, awkward has come up like this 15 times.
Yeah.
You have a city guy walking in the middle of the country. There's really no justification for that. And he just randomly picks up a conversation with some hillbilly leaning up against the fence.
It does have, completely anachronistically, but it does have a certain hee-haw vibe to it that I'm glad you also picked up on with the word hillbilly.
It does transition into a very hilarious bit about Ovine Aviation.
And what exactly are the commercial possibilities of Ovine Aviation?
Which, the voiceover by Eric Idle says, Avine Aviation, which is a nice sound alike, but not the right kind of animal. Avian, meaning birds, are already aviating. Ovine, meaning sheep. Bovine, meaning cows. Yeah, he just gets the word wrong. I did enjoy that the subtitles correct it. So even though his pronunciation has never been fixed, the word is ovine in the subtitles. For those of you who have the classic A&E special box set edition of the episodes, you will enjoy reading the subtitles because it presents them en français.
Bonsoir, ici nous avons les diagrammes modernes du mouton anglo-français.
Whenever possible, it gives you the French that they are quoting. They're saying that they're reading out loud. And I think their French is pretty good. It has a certain schoolboy quality to it, but it's solid. And they know enough to mock it and to start with a sentence and then to go into blither.
Ce n'est pas une manche, un pépé, le pompon, le manche,
Whereas the Netflix, and most of you who are watching this for the first time are aware of the fact that their easiest access to these broadcasts is currently on Netflix, where most of Monty Python's Flying Circus has been dumped with quite some ceremony. They've translated the French into English. And so the subtitles are telling you what they are attempting to say as opposed to what they're actually saying. And I find that a little annoying. Now, as somebody who knows a little bit of French, I like reading the French subtitles because then I'm testing my knowledge from 1993.
Plus, if you have Michael Palin saying,
Où sont les bagages? Où le voyageur? Le voyageur.
You may not know what ou means, but when he kind of puts his hand like, what? You get what he's saying. I think the joke doesn't really need a direct translation.
This is probably the part to follow up on my earlier bit. You said the phrase, suivez la piste.
Ah, merci beaucoup. Suivez la piste.
Ah, tais-toi.
Ah, pardon.
Nathan, do you know what suivez la piste means?
It means follow the something. I forget what the something is.
Track. Follow the track.
Follow the track. I think what it actually means is a colloquial way of saying, not yet. Hold on. I have the mustache.
That is what I always thought. I always thought that it was a reference to the mustache. In preparation for today's podcast, I thought I'd do a little digging and discovered that Suivez la Piste was the title of a 1966 BBC television book and record series that taught the viewers schoolboy French by setting it in a murder mystery. And so there's this young man who goes to a phone booth and he meets a young woman and she thinks that he's her spy contact and he leaves a message in the phone booth and then he stumbles accidentally. It's a wrong man North by Northwest mystery with enough English and then all the dialogue is in French so that you're practicing your French by listening to it. The whole thing is up on YouTube. You can listen to all the audio segments, and apparently it's still being used in schools today. If you go to Goodreads and look up the book, it's full of people going, oh my God, I had to use this in French class. This is the worst. Why does anybody still think that this book is a good thing to recommend? I'm convinced that dialogue is there because it's Palin and Cleese saying basically this is the level of French that we're using right now, is kind of crappy French that a second year student could understand.
When Cleese starts speaking French when he's handed the mustache, actually this is right at the top, he has this very long, when you actually translate it, it does make some cohesive sense. Mm-hmm. Something like, here we have a modern diagram of a sheep Anglo-Français. Anglo-Français is actually a breed of dog. I think they were stretching for something that was an animal that had this funny combination of two countries, Anglo-Français. I thought that was a little clever twist. But then pretty soon his French devolves into what I can only describe as orangutan-like poop sounds.
Yeah, definitely a lot of buzzing of the lips and raspberries.
Which could just be like carrying on with the affect of what French might sound like. Because the French do speak quite fast, and it all can kind of sound like this terrain of lip pressed together, farting noises, and gutturals.
Yeah, and it's a definite antecedent for what eventually becomes the French taunter in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. There's a clear lineage between these two characters.
I'm really glad we're talking about this sketch, because this actually tops the list of my top three favorite sketches in this episode. French lecture on sheep aircraft, and we are introducing it now.
Well, it's phenomenal. The acting is phenomenal. Michael Palin's inability to not laugh at Cleese is phenomenal. The jumping up and down dancing behavior is phenomenal. It's great. The fact that the wheels are just referred to as
les wheels,
les wheels, you see,
instead of whatever it be in French,
just les wheels.
Just abandonment of actual French for that one little bit. I think it's going to probably be an unfortunate tendency that the skits that make me the happiest over the course of the series will be the dumb slapstick ones. And yeah, just to have the two of them in lab coats jumping up and down, flapping their arms like they are Anglo-Français sheep that can fly, it's so dumb. And it makes me so happy.
It's also one of the first times that Palin and Cleese have been filmed together for this show. They did some other work back in How to Irritate People a couple of years previous to this, but this is the first time they're actually on screen together. And it seems to me like Palin is a little bit overwhelmed because his miming is a little bit too quiet and it's not quite as fluid. And it seems like he's doing something very erratically, which is funny to watch. But comparing him to Cleese is much more like the free, elegant, sort of limbering stork as he moves around these odd French ways.
There is an interesting bit where Palin leans into frame in front of the diagram, and then it cuts to him leaning into camera. And so there's this tiny moment of choreography that's based on the idea of a close-up. When he says, c'est formidable, magnifique, he does it by inserting himself into a close-up shot that hasn't started to happen yet. And it's a little clunky. It's definitely a moment of cut direction that doesn't quite work. But I think that there is potentially his stiltedness is based on an idea of where they thought the cameras were going to be and where they ended up being. That he was trying to keep himself out of frame so that he could then lean into frame. And I think that that may have made his physicality rigid.
We also see him crack up a little bit.
I love that.
A little bit towards the end. So I don't know which take this was. Mm-hmm. He may have been anticipating like losing it a little bit, and maybe this was the best take they got. They had 90 minutes of studio time to record each episode. That included things like costume changes, any kind of last minute technical change, and retakes for flubbing the lines. And some of these scenes are really long and there's a lot of lines to memorize. They all are pros at that, but when it comes time to doing physical comedy, there are other things which, like, timing is the thing you have to control, and that is probably the most difficult part of physical comedy. Difficult for the technical aspect, but also difficult because if it cracks you up, that could influence timing later on down in the sketch. So
when he passes John Cleese the mustache, he then promptly turns his face towards the diagram away from the camera as much as possible in order to try and regain his composure.
Exactly. It's very subtle, but it does happen. So this may have been the best that he could do. I mean, not that it's bad. Mr. Palin, it was fantastic, but it may have been the best take. It's actually funny to watch that he does crack up just a little bit. For whoever came up with the passing the mustache.
Oh, it's such...
That's genius.
It's such a tiny little perfect idea. It knocks me over. We've jumped straight into your top three. Do you have a number two that you're particularly fond of?
Second would be the man with three buttocks.
And now for something completely different. A man with three buttocks.
It's a fairly long bit, depending on how you're defining the sketch. There's the initial premise, there's the repeat for the continental version. There's a lot going on there. What chuffs you about this?
It's actually a very complicated sketch where there is a precursor and a postcursor.
Yeah.
Is that a word?
I like it.
What I am considering the best part is the reset of the sketch, where we see John Cleese and Terry Jones on stage in an interview style, which is a very typical BBC-type studio.
Good evening. I have with me Mr. Arthur Frampton.
Kind of awkward because John Cleese is asking about, well, you have an extra butt cheek, basically. But he's trying to do it in a way which is kind of at this poor guy's expense.
Now, look here, Mr. Frampton. It's perfectly easy for somebody just to come along here to the BBC, simply claiming that they have a bit to spare in the body department. The point is, Mr. Frampton, our viewers need proof.
But what I like about this more than just the content is that at some point they reset the entire sketch and start acting it again from the top.
Yes.
Verbatim.
Yes.
And now for something completely different. A man with three buttocks.
Good evening. I have with me Mr. Arthur Frampton, who...
Same physical moves, same lines, everything's the same. In fact, I was watching the two videos of the first time and the reset time, and the physicality is exactly the same. He clearly worked on everything. His leaning forward, his shuffling his chair, his pulling up his pant leg, his crossing his arm. Everything is exactly the same. But at some point in the second sketch, he stops, and then he says,
"We do this just now."
Oh, yeah.
Well, why didn't you say so?
This is a deja vu moment. Are we just repeating ourselves? And then Jones leads in with the great punchline.
I thought it was a continental version.
I don't want to take away at all from Cleese's performance because I think that his physicality is great. I think the awkwardness in which he's trying to figure out a way to say, to not say bum on television.
Your rump.
What?
Your posterior. Derriere.
Sit upon. What's that?
And then, of course, he's so abashed when when Terry Jones just cheerfully goes,
"I got three cheeks."
Yes, yes, spin.
But I think it's the bookends that really make this, because it starts off with Eric Idle saying, "And now for something completely different." And then after the three buttocks sketch, it cuts back to Eric Idle saying, "And now for something completely different," and starting the sketch over. At which point, once Jones gives us the line, "Oh, I thought it was for the continental version," it cuts back to Idle, who says,
"And now for something completely the same."
So the structure around it is what makes the repetition funny. It's because he's telling us this is something that's different, and then we get to see it again. And then after we've seen it again, he tells us, "And now for something completely the same," implying, therefore, we're going to see it again for the third time. At which point then we cut to...
"And now for something completely different. A man with three noses."
"He's not here yet."
"Two noses?"
This is the first time we hear the phrase, "and now for something completely different,"
right,
in Monty Python. It is not, however, the first time it's been presented as a BBC comedy bit. It was first said, as far as I can tell, in the 1948 show. It's a similar writer, same kind of quirky style. But it was said by this woman, Amy McDonald, who was kind of this lovable blonde ditz who would always talk about herself in the third person and how great Amy McDonald was. But at some point, like episode 6 and season 1, she says, "And now for something completely different."
I'm not entirely convinced that it might not have been the kind of continuity things that a announcer on the BBC wouldn't have used just realistically in order to paper over the kind of awkwardness that sometimes happens between news segments, where you start off by talking about this cheerful human interest piece, and isn't it great that we were able to save all those puppies? In other news, death in Uganda, you have that. The fact that news programs do have to move between totally unlike subjects, I do wonder whether or not the phrase was potentially actually used by genuine newsreaders and was leapt upon.
I'd find it strange if a TV news anchor actually said, "And now for something completely different." Sounds like there's just too many words there to say. They would say, "And now sport. And now the weather. And now Africa." They'd be a little more concise with how they would reintroduce things.
I think it's a good observation.
I also like how this man with three cheeks is the first time we hear the name Arthur Figgis, who is a character who comes up quite a few times. It is not Jones, it's not the man with the third buttock.
That's his
cycling friend.
Arthur Frampton is the man with three buttocks. We've got a lot of Arthurs in the episode. We've got Arthur Figgis, we've got Arthur Frampton. We have a character called Arthur Jackson, who's not Arthur Two-Sides Jackson. And we've got Arthur Ewing and his musical Mice, and Arthur Pewty. Seven, I believe, Arthurs strewn throughout Sex and Violence. It's just super Arthur friendly. I did a little looking into this. I'll come back to this as we get further on in the episode, but Arthur, according to the Office of National Statistics for Great Britain, was in the top 10 names of British-born boys from 1905 to 1925. In 1955, it was still ranked in the low 70s in popularities and would then drop off the top 100 until 2007, where it climbs back up to rank 35 by 2015. So if 1955, I don't have this off the top of my head, but we're assuming that most of the pythons were born in the early 30s for them to be in their early 30s now.
Cleese is the oldest. He was born 1939, okay. October 27th.
Late 30s, all right.
Next oldest is Gilliam, born 1940. And then the youngest, the baby of the group, is Palin, 1943.
Okay. So by the time the pythons were born, spread throughout the late 30s, early 40s, you have that sense that probably a good number of their friends were named Arthur. And so the idea of an episode just peppered with Arthurs, just, boy, that's a phrase I don't want to say five times fast. Just so many Arthurs running around before Arthur Dent also comes to prominence only a few years later, that it is this very ordinary name that one might think of as sort of, if you're going to think of an ordinary Briton, he's probably named Arthur, isn't a bad assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a rough parallel, Brian was in the top five by 1932, 1933, and then drops to the high 80s by 1985 and then disappears. So, interestingly enough, only a couple of years after Monty Python's Life of Brian comes out, Brian is totally eradicated from being the name of children in the UK. But you do find a lot of people also named Brian. Even in this episode, we have a reference to Brian Trubshaw, the pilot of the first ever Concorde air flight. Fairly ordinary, sort of salt of the earth. If you're going to name a generic Englishman, Brian's a pretty good shot on the old dartboard.
Even Michael Palin's character in the French lecture on sheep aircraft, his name is Jean-Brien Jetapatique. So they're just Frenchifying the name, Brian.
I'm glad you tackled Zepatatique, because as you can see, I'm just sort of faking it in the middle.
Do you have a favorite sketch you would like to bring up at this time, a good friend?
I would say that, hands down, the sketch that stayed with me the longest, or that I revisited the most as sort of finding secret depths to, was The World Around Us, The Mouse Problem, that ends the episode. Because mm-hmm. it fills in the same slot that in the previous episode, although recorded later, the funniest joke in the world. It's a good solid 5 minutes at the end of the show. And it starts to feel like that's perhaps the only structure that Python's got. That they start off with an It's Man, they move to titles, then when they don't have an ending to a short, they cut to Gilliam animation, and that the last 5 minutes are then the exploring and exploding of a single concept. And I think that coming back to John Cleese's acting, the acting in The Mouse Problem is pretty great. His performance of a man who's going through an allegory for being homosexual is pretty wonderful.
Well, it's not a question of wanting to be a mouse. It just sort of happens to you. All of a sudden you realize that's what you want to be.
And when did you first notice these, should we say, tendencies?
It is one of the three loudest laughs of the episode, which is something I wanted to highlight. That you get three, from the audience, you get three crazy loud laughs over the course of the 32 minutes of the episode. The second is when Rodan's The Kiss turns into an ocarina. The audience thinks that's hilarious. When he's blowing into her mouth and playing holes up and down her leg.
Mm.
The second loudest laugh is the use of the word cheese in this bit, where he says,
some of the fellas there started handing cheese around. Well, just out of curiosity, I tried a bit. Well, that was that.
As it's this sinful gateway into dressing up in mice a bit. The audience loves that. And I agree. I think that taking the ordinary cheesy comestible and turning it into something that is that scary, something that is at the heart of both British and French life, and having it be something that could be a gateway to having a vox pop of everybody in the country basically saying,
oh, well, I mean, they can't help it, can they? But, I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, so I'd kill him.
I think it's lovely. I laughed at it as well, although not quite as loud as the audience.
You have this overly dramatic camera move. Instead of doing a two-shot where they cut back and forth between the interviewer and the interviewed, they have a camera which is on a wheelbase that kind of swivels around, draws you in a little bit more. So that's a pretty complicated move. First time you see that kind of technicality.
The shot is one of the weird things that creates a moment that doesn't quite work on the show, in that the shot starts from behind Cleese, with Cleese partially in shadow, because that's the way in which you would be interviewed in order to protect your identity. And of course, there's the joke later that they say,
a typical case whom we shall refer to as Mr. A, although his real name is this.
And they give his name and address, therefore basically advocating a hate crime. But as it pans around to him, the light then slowly comes up. He starts off a little bit faded, a little bit in shadow, a little bit anonymized. By the time it's looking directly at his face, he is fully lit.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered, is that part of the joke, that the lights come up and we can see him? Or was it a technical aspect in that people needed the acting to be, or needed his face in order to understand it, and so they... instead of having it be sort of a muted light, instead of the complete darkness that somebody could hide in.
There are plenty of interview shows going on at the BBC at this time, where it's like one-on-one. They probably have a lot of experience with doing these kind of sweeping camera moves, just so the BBC can sort of show, flex its muscles. Like, see, we are a cinematographically adept institute. Mm. Take us seriously. And I think this was just recreating that. Now, having said that, I haven't seen any one of those interviews. I haven't watched any episode of Omnibus. But I can see that being a thing which, at the time, hey, we got wheels on these cameras. We get long enough cords that we can swivel them. Let's do that.
Just a couple of points about this concept of providing people's documentation under false pretenses. The episode is called Sex and Violence. This is in part because this episode was broadcast in a national atmosphere, international atmosphere, because a lot of conversation was happening about this in the United States at these exact years as well, about whether or not there was too much sex and violence on television. And so for Python to start off with their first recorded episode titled Sex and Violence, they're basically saying, you know what? We're going to put more sex and violence on television. Screw you, Mary Whitehouse. Because Mary Whitehouse was a prominent member of a morals group that felt like broadcasting of television needed to be clean, needed to be pure, couldn't have this stuff in it. And I have a pretty fascinating little bit regards to her, unconnected to Python. From a year earlier, 1968, Mary Whitehouse had called the Metropolitan Police and filed a report about the Doors, because they were going to be performing at a club in London. And she called the police and declared that they were a terrorist organization in order for the concert to be broken up. In the re-record of a couple of the skits in this episode, specifically the animation towards the end with the hungry pram that's eating the nice old ladies that look at it, a voice at the end comes in and says,
wait a minute, buckaroos, this is going far enough.
And it's a sort of Texan-y twang. It's redolent of the man in black with a big mustache that chastises Arthur Pudi and tells him,
are you gonna turn? And you gonna fight? And you gotta hold your head up high?
Yes.
Now you go back in there, my son, and be a man. Walk tall.
When it was redone for, and now for something completely different, the voice is a chastising female voice, and in fact, generally considered to be a stand-in for Mary Whitehouse.
Mm.
And just in terms of the particular concept of his details being revealed to the public, the address that we get on the card with Cleese's voiceover.
Arthur Jackson, 32A Milton Avenue, Hounslow, Middlesex.
is, according to legend, not the card that was originally broadcast, and that for all repeats, they had to quickly re-record Cleese's dialogue and put in a new insert card because the initial card that went out on the original broadcast on the 12th was the name and address of David Frost. And so they were biting the hand that fed them of their former employer by having it be implicitly saying, by the way, this is the scary man mouse that you should hate. This is the allegory of the great secret queer in our midst. Apparently, Frost was obviously pissed and demanded that it get changed. And there's an internal memo in the BBC saying, you know, we're going to have to fix this before it goes back out. And so almost nobody saw the original version. In terms of evidence that it exists, there's nothing out there. It's not on the tapes. It was re-recorded for all subsequent broadcasts. So if you didn't see it that initial time 50 years ago today, you didn't see it.
That's interesting. So at this time that Python was coming out, David Frost was kind of reaching the late autumn of his impact on BBC late entertainment comedy. Mm. He was pretty big in That Was the Week That Was, and of course the Frost Report, which brought a lot of these pythons to the fore in terms of being able to carry their own and holding a show.
Right.
But when it was the Cleese and Company's show to make, Frost was really just expecting that he would be the one producing it. Cleese just kind of like shooed him away. He's like, no, we're going to do this on our own. Because what that would have meant actually is Frost had created his own private production company. And there must have been some kind of like a patriarchal pressure if Frost had been there. It's like, well, I am the one who gave you guys your life. You have to pay homage to me. And I really don't think they wanted to be under the thumb of that. So I didn't know that when they're making fun of the man in the Man or Mouse sketch as being, here's his real name, and have it be David Frost. I didn't know that, but that makes more sense now. They're kind of poking fun at him for wanting to be in control of everything.
Yeah, I can definitely see that this group of, you know, young, full of piss and vinegar, taking on the establishment with the titles of their show, having episode 2 be episode 1, all these things. Who wants to do that under somebody else's umbrella? It makes much more sense that they would want to strike out on their own and just try things. And of course, the Man and Mouse skit is widely acknowledged as being something that they had worked on to be included in the Peter Sellers film The Magic Christian, and was then cut because, according to legend, Peter Sellers described the sketch to his milkman, and his milkman didn't laugh, so they got rid of it. Cleese and Chapman, who mostly worked that segment of the script, retained the rights to it because it was never used, and so they reappropriated it for this show. Similarly, the aforementioned man who's playing the musical Mice, whichever of the Arthurs that was.
Arthur Ewing,
yes, thank you. That sketch was apparently added in at the last minute, that it wasn't part of the initial filmed segments, but either to make up for time or to make up for a segment that was cut. It's unclear. It was added in. And so that's one of the reasons why it has a different feel to it. This first episode is very much a first episode. They needed to do reshoots, they needed to add stuff in, they needed to use material from previously in their career. They're grabbing from all quarters in order to make it happen. And it's that much more interesting that it's, in fact, episode 2.
I'm going to put on the list of favorite sketches, the working class playwright.
Oh, Dad, look who's come to see us! It's all Ken!
And about bloody time, if you ask me.
Aren't you pleased to see me, Father?
We talked a little bit about this last episode in terms of Python's relationship with satire and how I generally felt that last episode was more satirical in its awareness of format than it was specifically satirizing existing genres. This, on the other hand, flies in the face of that. This is just a straight up satire of the kitchen sink, taking it and reversing it.
So this sketch, if it were played straightly, and what I mean by that is if it was played out more like you'd expect, where the father is the actual gritty Yorkshire coal miner and the young up-and-coming playwright son is rebelling against his parents and their generation, that would be something I think most people would expect and feel like, you know, I know this scenario. But what makes it funny is they flip those two roles.
I like your fancy suit. Is that what they're wearing up in Yorkshire now?
It's just an ordinary suit, Father. It's all I've got apart from the overalls.
And at first, you just don't really realize it because the father is still talking like he is a Yorkshireman coal miner. And the young guy, played by Eric Idle, looks like he's talking like a Londoner playwright.
Yeah, the accent work is key in that you do have Chapman say,
"Hey, Now, wrong with gala luncheons, lad! I've had more gala luncheons than you've had hot dinners!
He's really leaning into the northern working class mining accent, despite the fact that he's saying, I can't believe you left London. That tension works really well for an ear that's attuned to the fact that their regions have been swamped.
Watching this in the 90s, it was not clear to me when they would refer to places like Yorkshire and...
Hampstead wasn't good enough for you, was it? You had to go poncing off to Barnsley.
Didn't really know what those meant, but I was only a couple of beats behind because the laughter from the audience informed me as like, oh, okay, this is funny. They must be playing on the meanings of these places. So you as the American audience, although you're not quite up to speed with exactly everything they're saying, you get it pretty quickly. And you get the fact that, okay, he's talking with a thick accent where he doesn't really say all the words. Like, I got a tongue in mead, I'll do talking. That itself informs that, okay, this guy is maybe a working class guy.
And so then the idea that he's jet setting around, flying to film premieres, and that his poor bedraggled wife is worn out from hosting film stars and having them over for tea and cocktails, and that he reeks of the finest red wines is, it's a good list of all the things that would not at all be the cause for somebody to be dressed like that and to be living in those sort of conditions.
Phrases like, you know what he's like after a few novels? It's his writer's cramp getting all the humor they can out of this role reversal. Yeah. Such a great performance by Chapman, though.
He's marvelous. And it's the sort of thing that he did well later in The Four Yorkshiremen. That same kind of deeply channeled voice, I think, works really well. I think it's time that once again,
bum, ba-dum, bum, bum.
I break out the 31-sided die of randomness, and we find out what you have to say about the Monty Python Minute. The Monty Python Minute is when I use random.org's random number generator to zoom in on a particular single minute in the course of the episode. Nathan will then watch that minute out of context with the rest of the episode. He will have 30 seconds to summarize that minute, and then he will have a minute and a half to say something extraordinarily insightful on it, and we will enjoy how much he ties himself up in knots trying to meet those deadlines. This is a bit of a satire on those minute podcasts that take huge works of great cultural importance like Star Wars or Heat and reduce them into minute-by-minute commentary over hours. And we're going to cram it in to 2 minutes because we have slightly greater respect for your time. So, Nate, are you ready?
Give it to me.
Random.org's minute for episode 2 is minute 5. That's minute 5.
Minute 5.
I'm not gonna call it the minute.
All right, Nathan, I'm gonna give you 30 seconds to summarize it. I will warn you at 10 seconds remaining and 5 seconds remaining, and then you will have to go into your minute and a half commentary. Are you ready?
Yes. Minute 5 starts off at the end of the French Ovine Aviation bit where they have the two Cleese and Palin jumping around like mime freaks. So they say, me. That transitions into a filmed bit with 4 Pepper Pops where the interviewer is asking, what do you think of French people? They basically list off all the famous French people,
you know,
like Voltaire, Descartes. And then that transitions to an animation of the thinker exploding. And then it goes into Arthur Figgis, Man with Three Buttocks.
Okay. So you got transitions. You got a minute of transitions. What do you have to tell us about this? What's interesting, important, crucial, or relevant?
The relevant thing for the end of the French aviation lecture is that then people asking the lady on the street, what do they think of French people? And I think at that time, there were some French people emigrating to England enough that it made it to be a talking point on Monty Python. And they had nothing but positive things to say, but they're of course referring to the greatest social influencers of that time and also of previous maybe 500 years of history. Voltaire, Descartes, and then they have what I like, Gilliam's, what I like most of this, Gilliam's animation of the thinker who has a thought bubble, says, I am. Gilliam himself comes in with a pen, pops that bubble. And of course, the thinker then disappears because he's no longer thinking. I don't know where I'm going with this, man. This is terrible. The ending bit was transition to Eric Idle sitting at the desk with a walrus behind him saying, and now for something completely different. A Man with Three Buttocks. First time we hear that from Monty Python. And then it's the beginning of Arthur Figgis No, the Arthur Frampton.
So many Arthurs. Buttocks
skit. So many Arthurs. Yeah, this one was a little bit difficult because there were lots of transitions.
Congratulations, you filled out your 2 minutes. Point out, Gilliam's hand coming in and popping the balloon. His hand comes in twice. We mentioned already the hungry pram. His hand comes down from the top and turns it around so that it goes ahead and attacks the dirty old man instead of the old women. Gilliam inserts himself into his animations a number of times, including once in a future episode where he's looking directly at the camera and talks to the audience and apologizes instead of being animated, being filmed by his animation camera. But I also feel like there is a god element to that. In the title sequence, in the first series, the foot comes down because God is in his cloud gesturing it to come down. It then happens randomly later. It just squashes everything. But in the first series, God himself is telling the foot to come down. And so you have that kind of divine influence. And of course, we have the skit in this week's episode where we have the wrestling match between the Monsignor and the Atheist.
Tonight, instead of discussing the existence or non-existence of God, they have decided to fight for it. The existence or non-existence to be determined by two falls, the two submissions, or a knockout.
And so we're determining whether or not God exists based on whether or not someone's going to win in a ring, a sort of an updating of trial by combat, where it used to be that instead of going to trial, you would have two men fight each other with swords. And if somebody got killed, then they clearly didn't have God on their side, and therefore they lost the trial. This is ancient English law. And so that presence of divine influence happens. And it's one of the differences between the, and now for something completely different version of Arthur Pewty and the Marriage Counselor and the version that we have here. As I've already mentioned, we have John Cleese and a mustache sort of playing a cowboy, telling him to get in there and take care of business. But in and now for something completely different, John Cleese, in fact, plays God from on high, telling Arthur Pewty to get back in there and fight for himself. I do feel like there is a heavy presence of the force of the divine throughout the series, which is kind of interesting, especially considering how many scraps they got in with religious groups and censorship over the course of their career. I will just merely point out that when we have the wrestlers, the Monsignor and Dr. Tom Jack, it seems very clear that Dr. Jack in the suit is going to win because he starts throwing the hell out of the Monsignor in his black robes. But at the very end of the episode, when we cut to the credits, we're told...
And here is the result of the epilogue. God exists by two falls to a submission.
So while atheism starts off with a strong, strong opening gambit, ultimately God is proven to exist and wins the fight off screen, which is a bit of a dirty cheat, but exactly the kind of a dirty cheat that I've come to expect from Jehovah.
There's another interesting thing about having them talk about somebody winning over someone else at the end of this episode, because at the end of the first episode, Wither Canada, they do the same thing where it was pigs, British bipeds.
Yes, where they really are bringing those running gags back and having the impression that they've been going on off camera the whole time, which is done here with the sheep, where we have the animation of the sheep flying and then being shot down by Michael Palin.
And they shoot the pig as well.
Right.
And that was the part of the show where we are going to hash through our top 5 moments of each Monty Python Flying Circus episode. Now, a moment, to be clear, is not a full sketch. It is just a short bit of film or tape or otherwise stuff in the episode, which just makes us smile. So, Ben, give me a favorite moment.
I'm gonna stretch the bounds of short bit as to why I like it with this first one. But the loudest laugh in the episode, as recorded from the studio audience, was during the Marriage Counselor skit when it was revealed that Carol Cleveland's name...
Wait, don't tell me. It's something to do with moonlight. It goes with her eyes. It's soft and gentle, warm and yielding.
Is Deirdre.
It's Deirdre.
They think that's just hilarious. And I spent quite some amount of time, once I was done figuring out how prominent the name Arthur was, trying to get to grips with, why is Deirdre a funny name? Why did the audience laugh? and I come to you today with no clear answer. It was not in the top 100 names ever in England. 6 people have been born with the name Deirdre between 1997 and 2017. 6. 3 in 1997 and 3 in 1999, and that's it. It's an astonishingly unpopular name. And yet I do find this weird, vague feeling that people thought that it was very, very common and that everybody in the audience certainly were like, oh yeah, Deirdre, there's a name that's common as dirt. But I have no evidence to back that up.
I just want to point out that this is the first time we see Carol Cleveland on the show. And wow. The pythons themselves were pretty all too happy to jump up and dress as women, but they all believed that none of them could play a sexy woman. So there are a couple of times throughout the whole series where they'll bring in somebody who is voluptuous to play that sultry part. And this is the first time we see Carol Cleveland, who does it quite a bit. She got her connection basically because she was already an actor. She was an actor model trying to scrape her way through that kind of career. She studied at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts with other notable people, including Anthony Hopkins, John Hurt, Ian McShane. These were her co-students at the time. And I think it was because she was working as a Playboy bunny that she had a connection through somebody who knew John Cleese. And so that's how she got the audition anyway. And then she got the part because she had really good comic timing. And her name is Deirdre Peaty.
Oh, that makes it so much worse. Oh, all right. Hit me with one of your top 5 moments.
I'm going to give a shout out to the 2 guys who play the wrestlers in the epilogue.
Yes, indeed.
So you have this guy, Monsignor Edward Gay, who they call Eddie Gay.
Visiting pastoral emissary at the Somerset Theological College and author of a number of books about belief, the most recent of which is the bestseller, My God.
Who the guy looks like a brute. His ears all banged up and freaky looking. He looks very menacing. And the other guy, Dr. Tom Jack.
Humanist, broadcaster, lecturer, and author of the book, Hello, Sailor.
Is enormous. He's wearing a tweed suit, but you can see he's a good foot in just filling out that whole thing. He's clearly they're both obviously wrestlers because the pythons couldn't do this themselves. But maybe it was because Monsignor was wearing this Catholic costume, made him feel a little weird, or because it was the first time filming for this new show, he felt kind of dumb. He really dials it in. You know, when they say, and now I have Monsignor Eddie Gay, he comes out on the wrestling ring and fakes it. It's like, what am I doing? But the other guy, Tom Jack, plays that so straight. He gives a good commitment, which, you know, he and Monsignor are in the same situation where this is a new show. Am I making an idiot of myself doing this? But I give the lecturer who wrote Hello, Sailor, I give him props for giving it a good performance.
I was able to find out the names of the actors. They were both hired through an extras casting agency called Tough Guys Limited.
No way.
And Monsignor is played by Terry Medlicote. Terry Medlicote, you may recognize from appearing as a genie in an episode of The Young Ones, where he comes out of a rusty tea kettle, whereas Brian Lancaster plays Dr. Tom Jack, and as far as I know, probably also played a background artist and a heavy in a bunch of things, but is uncredited in all of the rest.
But they're hired basically because they are muscly and ripped.
And so somebody had a binder full of big tough guys, and you went through and you figured out who you wanted to come in and play your bits, and then they still pasted that astonishing beard and suit onto Brian Lancaster. But you're right, he does his bit as the shill in the wrestling ring very, very well.
All right, Ben, another top moment.
Speaking of parallels, we've got Arthur Figgis riding behind Arthur Frampton on the bicycle and looking up and saying,
"Struth!"
at the fact that he's got 3 buttocks. I defy you, 100% defy you, to tell the difference between Arthur Figgis and Ron Geppo. As far as I can tell, they're wearing the same costume. They're both bicyclists. I don't know why they have different names. We have 7,000 Arthurs in this episode, including Arthur Jackson, but why is somehow he Arthur Figgis instead of Ron Geppo? I only noticed it for the first time, but boy did I notice that is the same character, potentially filmed on the same day. What about you? What else?
So the tail end of the mouse problem, as we talked about before, is a pretty long multi-element skit. Part I'm mentioning here as being a favorite moment is the line,
"The remainder of this film was taken secretly at one of these mouse parties by a BBC cameraman posing as a vole. As usual, we apologize for the poor quality of the film."
Making fun of the BBC.
That
makes
another
me smile.
Tiny little moment that I enjoy that I'm going to round us out with is with the amazing Cargill and Janet, when you have the interviewer say,
Cargill, speaking as a psychiatrist as opposed to a conjurer.
Oh.
And Cargill goes, oh. It's the deflated moment of, oh. But I really enjoyed doing this as a conjurer. It was so much better. And of course, to talk as a psychiatrist, he can't include the amazing Carol Cleveland as Janet anymore either. So it's a loss to all of us. But it does include the line that I perhaps quote most often, and nobody has any idea what I'm talking about, which is,
I mean, how many of us can honestly say that at one time or another, he hasn't set fire to some great public building? I know I have.
Which is perhaps my most obscure and favorite Monty Python quote, and the one that I would embarrassingly break out in high school and college to stunned silence.
Also, who else could play that role but Grant Chapman?
100%. I think that sums it up for another episode of The Python Perspective. Thank you for journeying down along with us through episode 2, Sex and Violence.
If you're listening, thank you very much for paying us with your ear attention. This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emley. Sound design also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
Editing for this episode was done by me, Nathan. You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, names, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect or represents you badly. Please contact us via the website or via our social media, and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Once again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan, my co-host is Ben.
It's truth!
And we'll see you next time when we discussed episode 3, How to Recognize Different Trees from Quite a Long Way Away. We got the oak, we got the elm, Douglas fir, Christmas trees, bonsai trees.